Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello.
And Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
Gentlemen, last episode of the year. Although, given the rate at which we've been publishing these episodes, we still have a few more, 2024 episodes.
We've been keeping them. We've been aging them like dried meat.
So there have been last few weeks have been some really rapid developments in AI, both OpenAI doing ShipMist, where they've released their Sora Turbo, which is their very fast video generator model. Google responded with VO2, which is a really high quality video model. It takes a much longer to generate videos, but the video quality there seems phenomenal. We'll see if we're going to get the full version of Sora at any point. But video generation is kind of in an amazing epic place. And then a week ago on Friday, Wall Street Journal put out an article, is AI hitting a wall? Have we reached this point? Are we just going to get into the land of diminishing returns? We're not going to push past benchmarks, Have we finally hit it? And there's a few classic have we hit the wall articles that are often weirdly timed with rapid, developments. There's one in 2019 that deep learning, we think it's probably at the limit, and the GPT-3 came out and all that. And it was like, yeah. Oh, ha ha, joke's on you. So article came out, Wall Street Journal, Friday morning. Hey, has it hit a wall? Then Sam Altman hops on an OpenAI live stream and announces the O3 model. There was the O1, which we talked about, reasoning model. They jumped right to O3 to avoid brand confusion with O2, network.
Oh yeah, O2 is a cell code. Yeah, or cell.
Yeah,
yeah.
So they have the O3 model, and on certain benchmarks, like one of them is, and I apologize, I won't get these numbers precise, but directionally true. A software bench, like the software engineering, like being able to see, how well the software engineer is the system able to be. The top AI model at that point scored 26%, 25%, 27%. O3 went up to 80%. Yeah. And it just was a huge jump. There is a thing called the ARC Prize, and an AI researcher by the name of Francis Chalet had put this out 5 years ago, which was to try to measure problem-solving capability and imagine a grid of tiles showing you, different tiles and trying to figure out which tile goes where, how would you repeat, if you have this pattern consist, repeat, whatever. And the top score there had been something 27%. The top human scores, being a bunch of people from Mechanical Turk, had been 76%. O3 scored 78%.
Wow.
Yeah. It went past the Mendoza line. So a few things there that you mentioned. The hitting the wall thing, the funniest meme that I saw relative to that was that indeed AI development has hit a wall, and then it showed the AI just over the last year of what they've done with that ARC challenge of O1 mini, and it just the hockey stick at which it's gone from 20% or 18% to damn near 80% at its most expensive model, and they just had a wall to the side of it. So it has hit the wall, and it just shoots continually upward because that is the trajectory that things are at. But let me ask you this, Maine. The big question, especially with the ARC Prize, is AGI. And while AGI, I think, is going to become something that people talk more and more about in specific details as opposed to this mythical land of sentience, I would say that O3 finding would suggest that at some point, especially with possibly another GPT coming from OpenAI, let alone what's happening with Google and Claude and Anthropic and everything, that we might get something that's going to be called AGI within the next 12 months.
Yeah, so we're at what we call the jagged frontier. And this was something that benchmarks from a distance seems like a pretty good benchmark. Then you get closer and you understand the technology better. And it's like, hey, would you guys like a car that goes, from 0 to 90? We're like, yes. Okay. Well, it can only go 0 or 90. Hey, I gave you a car, go 0 to 90. But I needed to go 45. I need to do this. And as you get closer, you realize, we call it the jagged edge, the jagged frontier, where you have really highly capable in some areas and limited in some other areas. And, when we started this podcast, the Turing test was the test everybody talked about. Like, you know, could you converse with an AI? Never realized it was an AI. And you know, the argument even then kind of been made like, well, it depends who's doing the questioning. Because we saw, you know, some early Turing prizes were won, you know, by, you know, an AI pretending to be a 14-year-old Ukrainian kid.
Yeah.
You know, and people, you know, plugging with the heartstrings of people going, oh, I'm talking to a kid, whatever. You saw the Google engineer, Blake Lemion, this guy get totally confused by a model you can run on your computer and insisting that this was... You
know, that guy's, I think, had been fried by hentai.
Probably very nice, sincere person, but a person who just didn't understand what was going on, et cetera. But anyhow, and what we've seen now is that as you get closer to these things, you realize, oh yeah, but I need this. And there's moving the benchmarks, you know, goalposts where you're like, no, this is what's going to be. And you know, there are people who are having debates going like, do these models really reason? And I keep asking, what is a test you have for reasoning that you would apply where you don't get to know the identity of the person in, you know, you're testing? And people who are like, oh, they don't reason, I can never get a good answer out of that. There have been some better tests that have come out where they have trickier problems to solve. And we see really smart AIs that score really well on conventional benchmarks fail. But we've also seen, with a little bit of prompting, showing that you could train these models to understand how they're being deceived, all of a sudden they get better. So as far as this next year when we hit AGI, it really comes down to how you want to define it. To me, it's like, can it do any information? Because I've heard people go like, oh, well, I'm embodied. I can change oil in my car. I can do this and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, well, Stephen Hawking, so are you saying that, you know, he's not intelligent? I think it comes down to, it comes down to utility. Is it useful for you? And like ChatGPT is not useful for many people, you know, either because they don't know how to use it or it can't do the tasks they want to do. And I think that we may arrive at what would be for all the tasks that Justin and Brian have to do that you'd be like, yeah, this is as effectively as smart as somebody I would hire to do this. And I think that could be next year.
So you do believe that something is going to be labeled AGI within the next 12 months?
Well, I don't know who does the labeling. I would say that in the next year, we see how spooky it is to have conversations in advanced voice mode. I think that I have spooky moments all day long when I code and I use these models to solve stuff. I think that when you have an AI take over your computer and it's really reliably handling your email and doing stuff, that you feel, I think each person's going to have their own. Will a company come out and say, we've done AGI? I don't know if it's really, you know, I don't think it's an OpenAI or Google's best interest to do that.
Well, but they might clear that benchmark. They might clear that ARC prize, at which point, I mean, they can just say that we've done a 99th percentile on this thing that measures AGI.
Yeah, but they're working on a new ARC prize because they've realized it's 5 years old and now they want a new prize. So,
yeah, but I mean, if you look at the exponential growth on that, it would not shock me if we saw something like that be able to conquer even a new prize or a new puzzle.
I would put it this way. I think next year we would see something that would absolutely meet any definition of AGI, reasonable definition we would have come up with 5 years ago.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I believe that 100%. But what's interesting is... So whether the black box is a human or an AGI, there's still the interesting question of, do you trust it enough to make it a part of the foundation of your business? Like, for example, what I worry about is not so much, I don't worry about competence when it comes to handling my emails, because you can't be less competent than me right now. But I do worry about security, privacy, that kind of stuff, you know, hacking, not that they would sell data, but that, you know, we're into the realm where state actors might be interested in it. And then on top of that, like, we're already at a place where there are players, you see this chatter on the OpenAI subreddit where people are knee deep in a very long D&D campaign, and then they just hit their token limit, and then like the transformer can no longer remember the beginning of the campaign because, you know, it gets exponential with all the resources that it takes, and so now they have to upload summaries, and the robot is essentially, you know, making it up as it goes. Of course it's making it up. But my point being is, we don't know that 5 years from now, whatever it is we're using LLMs for will still be supported. Does that make sense? So it's like, if you put a lot of time, energy, and effort into it, you'll want backup documents. For example, I trained the pro mode reasoning model. I said, look, ask me one question at a time, and I'll answer any one question, but your goal is to create an infrastructure map of all of the IT. And so it just says, I'm like, start with my Ring cameras. He's like, great. How many Ring cameras do you have? And so I answer that. And it's like, what do they plug into? What does this plug into? What edition, what version is that? You know, do you have this? Do you have that? And it's building it. And I'm 5 or 6 days into answering all these, but then it occurs to me that that's an awful lot of work I've put into it. And I worry about the rules changing and suddenly it forgets everything that I've done so far. And I think that's the thing that I think humans need to be cautious about, not about a computer being smarter than you do or don't believe it is.
Yeah. I mean, the famous IAM Pi example of architecture was you put your buildings up, see where people walk to, then you build your sidewalks.
Right.
And we're at that with AI, where we give people these really powerful models, we see how they use them, then we find out what's more important. Is document retrieval more important than an infinite context? And Sam Altman's talked about infinite context.
Can you summarize that for me?
So infinite context, the concept is basically you would just have continuously on, never worry about, do I need to save a thread, whatever, and a system would understand what's relevant. You know, you have Google's models, like they'll have like their Gemini, they're up to like 2 million tokens. The challenge though is that it's not the same as I can give it 2 million, you know, a million words, but if I give it a million instructions, is it going to follow every one of them? No, you know, and that's where, is it going to remember every fact? I've tried this. I'll give it my book and like name every character in this book, and it won't. It'll give me, you know, like 8 or 9 characters. Then it'll say I'm good. And so context has to improve over time. But the goal is infinite context and context, intelligent context, to basically understand what you're trying to do, not just where to find it in there, but holistically how much of it you need to do. So I would say that the problem you identified, you know, remember when we had access to GPT-3 and context was 2,000 tokens.
Right.
You know, and, you know, your output was a few hundred reliably at best. So I think that eventually we'll learn it. Like, think about this. I remember Steve Jobs going on stage at Macworld and showing one of the features of one of the applications and talking about infinite saves. Like you could undo, infinite undo. And that was like mind blowing. Like, oh my God. I mean, I can keep hitting undo, because it used to be when we first started using computers, you had to click save all the time.
Yeah.
And then after a pirate period of time, you know, developers realized I should probably auto save every 5 seconds if there's a significant change. And as computers got faster, I need to auto save every time there's a keystroke. And AI is sort of the similar thing. As you're saying, what do we need to do? We need, well, smarter models, one thing, but man, models that I can just keep going at forever. And so, you know, it has a certain kind of retrieval right now with context, but it's not, there. So I guess the things you build today are going to look primitive to the things we're going to build tomorrow, but you want to make sure the things you build today work.
Yeah, or just that there's some record for me to feed it. Like, I have no doubt that the model will be totally different. And this thread that I'm building, you know, I should have summaries. Like, hey, write everything out that you know that I just told you. And then, you know, I'll email it to myself so that...
That's what model. I've done. Like, I had a thing where I just had an idea for a segment and I just, like, told... advanced voice mode while I was on a walk, there's like, ask me questions about this idea. And I just, you know, info dumped all the stuff that I wanted, into advanced voice mode while I was on the walk. And then at the end, just be like, okay, please summarize everything that we've said. So not only will I have the summary, but I'll also have the thread of the conversation that I can, you know, then do something else with, like either re-record or summarize and put into different words so I can, you know, read it into a camera.
we'll find out, you know, as more people use it, we find out like, you know, how these things are used. When I use Cursor, which is what I use for my code editor, there's a mode called agent mode, which is really cool. Cause when I go into agent mode and I say, hey, I need to build this application, it creates all the files, puts them in a folder, it does that. And it has a really long memory and, you know, use, and they've got some very smart methods they use behind the scenes to keep track of what you're doing. But I can tell once, you know, I get to a single page of code that's like 2000 words long, I can start to see, oh yeah, this is running into an issue. But on the other hand, you know, people are working very fast to solve these problems. I built a tool, which maybe I'll show you guys next time, which uses OpenAI's WebRTC protocol, which is basically you can just have put in about 12 lines of code onto a web page and it will connect to the OpenAI servers and you have a chatbot built into your web page and it can do tool use. And so I built it for storyboarding. I can just say, create an image of this, create a background of this, create this, and it just starts filling up a corkboard with all these things. And that's possible now because the backend engineers figured out, how do we reduce the complexity of the code to build this thing? And they did, you know, to 12 lines of code and everything else is handled on their servers. And we're just going to get more and more and more of that. I think a lot of things that are problems for us now are going to slowly fade away. We're not going to think about them. But to the point about trust, you brought that up, Brian. It's a great point. And I think that if anytime you bring on a new employee, you have to allow for a certain amount of time to onboard them. And, you know, a metric we've used at OpenAI when I was at OpenAI was AGI isn't just a matter of being as capable as a person, has to be economically efficient. And O3 was able to score like really high scores on the ARC prize, but for
great
the case
expense,
of,
right?
Yeah. They were spending, you know, thousands of dollars and stuff on, you know, total token cost. Like there was a huge amount of token cost to figure out how to do it. Now, the flip side of it, that is though, and a kind of a segue into another story is that once an AI walks through the steps of solving a problem and you have that documented, you can feed it to another AI that can learn how to solve those problems, not by having to do it in so many
steps,
different steps. Yeah. But doing it in one, you know, fell swoop. DeepSeek.
I was just going to bring that up. It's like, which I think we could probably segue to one of the stories of today in AI, and that is a brand new model, which has had a lot of people buzzing, a Chinese model by the name of DeepSeek, right?
Yeah, so DeepSeek is a very capable model. It's a company, an AI company in China. And China's been in this situation because of our fear of, you know, China, you know, China winning the AI race. One of the things that our government decided to do was to limit the sale of GPUs to China. I don't really have a hard take on that other than you have to be prepared for unintended consequences. And one of those being is that there, and part of my frustration, some of the people involved in safety and some of the people involved in this is that their understanding of this technology is really quite limited. And they're like, well, if it took this many GPUs to build ChatGPT, then we'll just keep them from having that many GPUs. It's like, well, you may not need that many GPUs to build ChatGPT. You know, that was a way to build it. And, you know, the United States thought they had a 10-year advantage over Russia when it came to nuclear technology. And the Russians decided, yeah, no, we really want nuclear technology. It took them like 3 years. By the way, you know, as we moved to thermonuclear and lighter weight nuclear power, and we kept that locked down, Russia said, well, we don't know how to build those. We'll just build bigger rockets. And so the entire Russian space industry and part of Russia's space dominance was based upon the fact they figured out how to build really, really huge rockets because they didn't think they were going to be able to develop smaller nuclear warheads. Eventually they did. So they ended up with small nukes and huge rockets. And so you have to be prepared. And it's not an argument for an action not doing anything, but you have to be aware or mindful that if you limit something or somebody else with constraints is going to come up with different solutions than you may have. So DeepSeek, because they are GPU limited, they had to figure out all these other ways in which they could optimize and make the most use of whatever processors they have. So this meant that they spent a lot of attention looking at how the little algorithms work, how they put data through there. Do they use spectral mechanisms to make sure that they're using data more efficiently? And so the paper they put out is a really, really insightful paper into all these different techniques that they did. I won't call it PsyOps though, but I will say that the paper left out a very, very important thing they did. And this is not the reason that the model became very capable, but it's one of the reasons they're able to do an efficiency is in previous DeepSeek models, if you asked enough times, its identity, it would tell you it was ChatGPT. DeepSeek 3 is the same thing. You know, one out of four times, if you go, what model are you? In my experience, it will say, I am GPT-4. If you ask it to show you, to explain how to use its API, ask it, you know, one out of three times, it'll show you the OpenAI API. Claude doesn't do this, right? And if you are, one of the things we found out post ChatGPT was, if you want to bootstrap a model, we do a thing called distillation, which is, instead of taking all just the raw internet, I take billions of tokens, billions of words of outputs from an AI model solving problems, because that's really high quality data. Write a blog post about this, write a thing like this. The model spends less compute space trying to figure out how to solve the problem and can get better at it. So from my experience, it looks like DeepSeek 3 trained on top of billions of tokens of outputs from GPT-4, maybe from other models. That's not why it's performing. That's not the sole reason it performs as well as GPT-4 or Sonnet, or better in some cases. But it is certainly one of the reasons they were able to do this model. They said they only spent $5 million to build the model. And people are like, oh, if you could, you know, somebody like, look what they did. You could, you know, Tony Stark in a cave did this. Like, you know, if Tony Stark could build in a cave, like, look what they did with only 5 million, this many GPUs. I'm like, well.
And access to existing GPTs.
Yeah. And again, it's not to diminish what they did, which I think is amazing. Yeah. But it is to say, like, if there was no OpenAI, there had been no GPT-4. My argument is this model would be nowhere near as capable of this, because so much of what they got to use were high quality tokens. I think they still would have had a good pathway to building a very good model two or three generations down the road. But when you can take billions of tokens and distill down a bigger model into your own model and then build on top of it, it's great. And again, I'm sure on Twitter, people are like, oh, you're just upset. I'm like, no, I think what they did is cool. But if we're going to pretend they weren't using billions of tokens of GPT, yeah, that's not a factor in there, then we're not really learning what they did.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see the dialogue around it. Number one, because the tier list of AI attention very much has OpenAI as the lead dog. So anything that shakes up the tier list in any way is something that people are very, very fascinated by, almost as a reaction to OpenAI as much as anything else. But DeepSeek specifically, especially when you see some of the stuff that is able to be replicatable, of asking what its name is, and it's saying that it's GPT 3.5, or it answering the same to certain joke call outs and stuff like that. It's just, look, I think we're going to see a lot more DeepSeeks going forward, then we're probably going to see the level of frontier models that are going to come out. This is just another branch of what is essentially this computer science.
Yeah, and DeepSeek's an open source model, and that's to their credit. Yeah. They've contributed this model, and that's why there's so much excitement out there, as people who like don't want to pay a tax to OpenAI or Anthropic are like, hey, now we've got this model that seems very efficient and very, very highly capable that can do that. And that's part of why too that, you know, I'm out there going, yeah, but it wasn't just a $5 million. It was a $5 million model built on top of a $1 billion model. Like, don't ruin it for us. We want to believe. It's like, you have a great model. It was very likely used, breaks terms of service from OpenAI, very likely used what they would, you know, could be legally liable, you know, training. So they're not going to release the training data for it. Like, that's the thing now. Like, they just, like, you know, but I, you know, from a technical point of view, like, I think they did some very clever innovations, and yeah, they train on top of a bunch of things. But yeah, and I think that's part of it, is the open source community wants to believe this thing, like, we don't need them, we can do this. It's like, maybe, but we haven't done it so far, you know? And
you have not done it without building a model based on the, you know, billions of tokens that have come out of a frontier model.
And the frontier models were built also on top of open source code and stuff like that. And so but it's not as clean. You know, I've heard people, oh, it's clean. It's like, no, this is not clean. It's not clean. It is not that. Yeah. The one of the other examples too is, it used to be right after ChatGPT, you could tell which models were actually using ChatGPT outputs. And maybe even a major company whose name I will not name, because I like people there and I don't want to make a claim, but if you would ask ChatGPT, you know, tell me a joke, it'd go, why don't scientists trust atoms? And say, because they can make up everything, right? GPT-4 got a new joke, which is, if you say, tell me a joke, it's like, why don't skeletons fight? And it says, because they don't have the guts.
Yeah.
Ask DeepSeek to tell you a joke. Skeletons don't have the guts. It's like that to me. It's like, and somebody said, oh, well, that joke's online. I'm like, yes, and there's a million jokes online. Why is it the same joke that comes up? You know, which tells you that, again, I could be wrong. It could be an entirely clean data set and somehow the model.
It's not, though. I mean, sure. Yes, possibly satire. But, you know, it's not. It's built on the output. It's fine.
Yeah. So
come at me, Beijing.
Yeah. Anyhow, again, and major accomplishment. And that's the thing we have in mind going forward. And to any policymakers that may have actually stumbled upon this podcast, who's thinking about how you maintain that the free countries of the world have, you know, the AI supremacy, is to understand there's no magic remedy. There's no magic, we'll cut off. Because, you know, we cut off GPUs. The other problem too, the GPU cutoff was, and again, I'm not saying I'm against it, but the challenge with it was, one was, we know that they could buy them through Malaysia. Second was, China can produce like 7-nanometer, like 8-nanometer chips, which they're not economically viable if you're trying to sell the chips on a market where you're competing with NVIDIA, et cetera. But if you're the Chinese military trying to build a 250,000 GPU cluster, that's fine. It doesn't matter. Like you guess what? They could build a cluster. And I think I get people who are paid safety researchers, like, oh, they can't. Well, it's like, oh, they can't. Like, no, here's the Chinese version TSMC. Here's how they're able to do this. But it costs more. I'm like, okay, so we've established it's not physically impossible, it's just a matter of cost. Do you know anything about military spending?
Well, also, you know, they got to form a government over there that, you know, has their own definition of what cost is.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're pretty hands-on with those kind of things if they believe it is of national interest.
My prediction of DeepSeek is that the $5 million tag that they said that they trained on it, which is affordable for many, many different companies, you're going to get a number of other companies who are going to try to replicate this, and they're not, because the data, they're going to realize that the structured data really matters.
I hope we get as much out of it as possible. I think that we just need to understand that whatever is happening here with feeding the other data in, we should be paying more attention to exactly how that is happening and how that information is synthesized, as opposed to being puritanical about the idea that, like, oh, they figured out a way to do it totally clean. It's like, well, they didn't, but still, figuring out how they can get a model that is very capable, unable to tell you what happened in Tiananmen Square.
So the funny thing is, it will, and they have a post, like, remember the thing with the ChatGPT, if you asked it the name of a person and it would stop generating that? DeepSeek will do that too. It will actually start to do Tiananmen and it'll backtrack and it'll go erase it. So the model actually has that information, which shows you just, you know, how...
That it didn't come from China.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think this is an important part of this world. It doesn't make it diminish that they didn't do it clean. It just means this is a version of LLMs that we are going to see going forward.
Mm-hmm. And some clever, very clever strategies.
And I like the parallels with nuclear physics. It's like, at the end of the day, if doesn't matter how Russia got to a nuke, doesn't matter if they did it intellectually honestly, doesn't matter if they had spies steal it. At the end of the day, they got a nuke.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And that's, to me, it's like the part of the reason why we got to go fast, why America needs to be in the lead, and we need to understand that, like, the world will be better if we are at the front of this, and we are now, but, you know, I think that there's ways that we can not be if we want to dilly-dally.
My kind of takeaway that I'm trying to emphasize through my insistently, I've been pasting the outputs of DeepSeek into everybody's, you know, on that I find in Twitter, that's like, oh, look, you don't need the Frontier Labs, you did this, and I just keep posting that, like, are you sure? Are you sure that you would have got here right now at this point in time without, you know,
the Frontier
problem? You know, like, I understand the wanting to believe, but
yeah,
the evidence is otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, like, Christmas was a couple days ago. We don't need to believe in Santa Claus.
Yeah. But still, again, great achievement, and shows there's a lot of other innovations can be done. So.
cool. Hey, a couple of threads. We could follow whichever one you want. One, YouTube is rolling out the ability for creators to opt into the AI training capability. It is off by default, and it does not specify whether or not it's the checkbox simply says yes, allow YouTube to share. Now, does that mean sell and make a profit on? Does that mean share with the goodness of their heart so that your artistic contributions can contribute to a model? Or is this a gateway that will eventually lead to a negotiated price where you will get paid a flat fee? And yes, I approve of these models and not those models. Nobody knows, probably not even YouTube at this point, but they started with a by default, it's opt out for AI scraping, which I thought that was interesting to watch in real time. We had spoken previously about, you know, the hangups a lot of people have about who owns the creations, especially in the art world, et cetera. And I had proposed that we're looking towards a future of, I don't know if they're sarcastic air quotes or not, but ethically sourced LLMs, where people who are sensitive to being compensated will be compensated. And I don't know. It's interesting to see that go from the theoretical and hypothetical to boots on the ground actions being taken by the number one video platform on the planet.
Yeah, I kind of, my take on it is I'm not sure where copyright law is going to land on how you use it. Because, you know, my argument sort of thing is like, if I'm learning from a thing, you know, from a lot of different examples, like a person does, even if it's at scale, that seems pretty fair to me. But since YouTube is saying, let's have the conversation, and, you know, and I'm like, well, okay, you know, I was kind of the mindset of, you just did it, then I put it out there. Because you think about all of our podcasts are out there, by the way, like, which we probably would use to train, you know, voice models and stuff.
And also it's like, look, there's what's good and right around the campfire. And then there's what's good and right when I'm in the middle of backing up 15 years of discussions between the three of us. And I'm like, man, if there's a check to be cut for for our contribution to humanity, I wouldn't mind getting a check. Now, you know, by default, I don't expect that this thing that we created and published to put out to the world. I don't believe in the right to be forgotten laws of the Europe or whatever. However, if somebody's in a check right mood, I'd like to get some high quality data.
The expectation is based totally on the number we see flying out there for other things, right? Like when you look and see, oh, okay, OpenAI is spending $44 billion a year, for example. And then you wonder, oh, really? Okay. Well,
where's
I've
my
got
cut?
A lot of stuff. Like, I don't know. Do I get $150? Do I get 10,000? Do I get, you know, like, or even just the idea of like, hey, is there some place where I can willfully volunteer? Like, do you want clean versions of it? But then again, that is under the assumption that all of the stuff that we have put out onto the internet for free for enjoyment hasn't already been scraped and hasn't already been hoovered up. That, like, guess what? We already made that deal. We made that deal when we decided to put it out on the internet for free.
Well, and the only difference now is that we're closer to being able to quantify what our presence in the global gestalt is, or, you know, whatever, in the global consciousness. We, of course, it's too processor intensive to actually get a specific number, but in theory, some percentage of the conversation, whatever the conversation is, we can now track and know how much of it we are.
Yeah, I think that the question comes down into is like the compensation part, where we're going to be find out that we're not worth anywhere near as much as we think we should be.
Yeah, certainly not as much as we want.
Right.
You know, when you say yes, and then you get your check for 73 cents.
Yeah. Well, like, that is something that that to be clear, I am not expecting a magical payday of any variety like that. However, I do expect that maybe within a year, all of this past 20 years of content that we've created, I can feed into a personal LLM and we can be fascinated and gather around a virtual, you know, we could have a debate between the three of us, modern day incarnations of ourselves versus ourselves from 15 years ago. That's the thing I believe in the next year. You know, it's been a minute since we made predictions, but I believe we can do that sometime in 2025.
I think we could have GPT-2 reliably recreate.
I think we could have a hat and a bunch of slips of paper and take us on.
Yeah. You guys want to do predictions for 2025?
Yeah. Before we do, just one quick little note. I had been predicting the Comic Sansification, the papyrusification, and it's been fascinating to watch people begin to recognize AI in the wild. I don't think my in-laws, nobody tell my in-laws, but they bought a quilt for my daughter who was very excited. And then she counted the number of fingers on the dragon and she was very polite, but she was visibly disappointed to realize where the sourcing of this quilt imagery came from. And I think that's utterly fascinating to watch everybody become more aware of AI stuff.
Yeah, I saw an article that said that like a lot of the home goods, a lot of their items they put out now are using, you know, AI generated content.
Well, and also, which,
how many fingers should a dragon have?
Probably fewer than seven.
All right.
And probably good fingers. Fingers shouldn't be coming out of other fingers as well.
Yeah.
This is like a Springfield dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, you know, we're going to pay attention to it, then stop paying attention to it, then nobody's going to care.
Yeah. I mean, I think the, you know, Brian, you had something that stuck with me that when you first got into video editing in the, like, you know, 90s and 2000s, that you had these few presets that you would put on things. And then immediately, whenever you saw those presets in the wild, you would immediately assume that that professional product was low effort. Cause you're like, I know how to do that. Like that's like that's ridiculous. And like, I remember I had the same thing with the music beds that were like in GarageBand. And it's like, as soon as you hear that, you're like exactly. And you're like, oh, okay. Wow. Home by five, huh? But like immediately, anything that you can do, you assume is low effort. And part of that was the prosumer revolution where you had really good tools like Final Cut, like GarageBand, that all of a sudden you could make something that was professional on a kind of more entry level way. And now AI in many ways gives everybody that. And so I do wonder whether or not there is just a reputational hit, as everybody has our own little self-loathing complex to be like, oh, like, is that a cool dragon? I don't know. I could have done it.
Well, and the good news is the three of us have had a very, very unique front row seat. Not only have we watched AI develop, but we come from the background of magic, where all the magicians know that they're pressing an easy button and they're using a preset plugin of a routine, and they become very possessive of it and weirdly tribal about it. You know, they call it the curse of knowledge. And because a magician, you know, for example, the thing that got me in the hottest water was teaching how to stick a deck of cards together in a novel way. And I did not perceive it as a valuable thing at all because it cost me $5 to learn at my very first magic convention ever. Meanwhile, to other people, this was the greatest secret in all of time and space. And they got very, very upset about it. But meanwhile, there's an entire generation of up and coming 20 somethings who are going to have jobs in the creative arts, who are going to grow up perceiving that all of this stuff is low effort. You know, I guess I'm just taking another lap on the same thing I was saying, but
I, I will defend my use of every New Tech video toaster transitional wipe on my first Magic video.
Yes.
So, the rate at which it makes it easier to produce stuff is incredible. The conversations we're going to have, we see like the AI hallucination thing it's still there, but it's not as much, there's still, well, there's a tech reporter who cracks me up because every 2 weeks or something, it's some screed against ChatGPT and how it's not reliable. And they never mention that you can use search and never mention that you can use citations. And I'm pretty sure at this point, ChatGPT is much more reliable than this tech reporter is when it comes to the topic. But you're right, it's like it struck a nerve. Like there's this, I think there was the story was Washington Post. Bezos was interviewing people to take it over and said, I want to understand, tell me how you're going to use AI to improve the newsroom. And a lot of people had a problem with that. Like, oh, we're not going to use AI to improve the newsroom. And as the guy who writes 2 books a year and builds tools, I can tell you there are 1,000 ways I can improve the publishing process and never have to have the AI write a word.
Write a single word.
And that's, I think that it's a, I think part of the problem is that Justin and I did a project early on where we talked to reporters and we would talk to people running newsrooms, and we realized there was a very big disconnect between even people who became reporters and then started to run newsrooms between what is your time spent doing? And it's not finding the right words on the keyboard. It's sourcing stories. It's doing all this. There's all these other areas where you could speed it up and still let the reporter write the story. And sometimes reporters go, I would like an AI to write the story too. It's like, well, what if you had all of your notes in front of you? What if you have all of your notes in order in which you want to use it? What if you had an outline for what you want to do? And then I sat you down and said, okay, you do you. And people are like, oh yeah, that'd be great. You'd find out it takes you 30 minutes. Something took you 2 hours at that setup. So I think we're going to see, people start to realize, oh, there's a lot of other little steps that I forget that are really what take up the time, and AI can help with that. So 2025.
Yeah. You know what? I got one I'm going to stand behind. We're going to see Starship land. Both the top and the bottom, it's gonna chopstick it with the bottom half and land the top half. A-okay. 2025.
Which part of
2025?
Come on. We've watched both parts land, one in the ocean, one on that. We haven't watched the top half land yet on land. So
I'll say. You know what? I'll go. Do we have a schedule of when the attempts are? I'll say within the next. I will say the very first time they announce they try it, they're going to land it the very first time.
Okay.
So I don't know enough about the schedule, but I'm going to say they're going to go one for one and it's going to blow our minds.
It's a shame because actually I don't know if this episode is aired yet, but on Daily Tech News Show, I will be predicting that there will be a company that will announce AGI. So I've already made that prediction. I don't know.
Let me ask you, like, when you say a company, I mean, some $20 million startup that's going to say, hey, we've done it because they want the headlines.
My justification was what we had won over before, that there is going to be a benchmark for which will be cleared, and whether or not the company says it's AGI, it will be understood to be AGI. And I think that there are questions of, and I don't know the specifics of it, of whatever Microsoft and OpenAI's relationship is and whether or not there is a barrier or a change or a meaningful change to their relationship should an independent board that they have set up determine that something is AGI, but whether or not there are financial incentives for that to happen, I don't know. There's obviously a lot of rumors about that there, but that was just my prediction that a benchmark will be cleared.
I certainly think there are still questions about how the AI would do with long form tasks, long form things like this. like writing a full novel that's coherent. You know, you can get an AI to spit out something that looks like a book, but when you try to read it, it's like, oh, these are very great.
Yeah.
Or you get like, these are really good self-contained chapters that list to connect. But yeah, I think that for many knowledge work tasks, like the average person going into a job and having to, you know, what they type into a keyboard, we're going to find AI is going to be really good for, you know, seven. And it might be too that like, you know, like I said before, is it might be able to do, it might not take over 70% of jobs. It might take over 70% of your job.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, I was having a conversation with my brother-in-law last night that like, where I would lean the future to going is not that there is a mass elimination of, you know, he's an engineer, like that there's a mass elimination of engineering jobs, because the company that has a crap ton of engineers, like they're already set up to be paying for that. And if you are going to say, okay, well, there's a greater capability here, but you can have a choice. You can move at your current pace and pay somebody less, or you can ramp up your runway and now your 5-year goals can be your year and a half goals because everything's going to be going a lot faster. What do you choose? And I would assume that, you know, the majority of good companies would probably choose to the second one. They would want things to be more productive and go faster. And that's also where I think that the tools are kind of tailored for now. We've yet to see just, you know, I think there's more likely to be an underclass of AI employee that is taking on very specific tasks reliably than there are just like, okay, it's Doug, Carl, and robot. You guys are now the engineering department.
You know what?
Everyone's going to get a robot.
It seems like a bit of a mirror image echo of, there's a book called The Walmart Effect. And I guess that would be, so there's the seen and the unseen, the seen detriment with the Walmart, efficient, chain of, you know, pipeline was that, you know, mom and pop stores that were inefficient got squeezed out, and you could point to those lost jobs and those shut down mom and pop stores. But what most people were missing is the fact that all of humanity got essentially a $10,000 cost of living raise, you know, in terms of the abundance of everything that you have directly attributable to Walmart. And then, of course, that happened again with Amazon, and now Walmart's feeling the squeeze or whatever. What it sounds like you're describing, Justin, is kind of a version where, no, we're not all going to get laid off. We're just all of a sudden all going to expect more from our teams, and the teams will be able to deliver more, richer, and faster.
I think it's going to be very uneven. I do think there's going to be a lot of layoffs. I think that there's going to be a lot.
I think that there's some industries that I think are going to get just raptured.
I think that there's some companies that, you know, I had a conversation with somebody the other day who'd started using AI to handle a certain form of ticket management. And the company that they were outsourcing this to said, hey, we don't want you to use AI. You know, we don't want you to hire people. And they said, well, we're going to have to hire 50 more people. And, you know, you're going to have to pay us, you know, $500,000 more a year or whatever to handle that. And they're like, well, we didn't have to pay that before when you use people, you know, why do we have to pay that now? You know, like where did, you know, who got the benefit from that? Mm-hmm. And I'd say that certain industries are very slow to move, and these benefits won't directly be downstream to customers for a while, which is all the more reason to kind of encourage more innovation. And I think we're going to see that uneven thing. We're going to see that, you know, some companies are going to do this, but you know, if they're having record profits, they're going to create opportunity incentives for other companies to go in there and to try to do it. Or, you know, we get weird legislative things that go in there where the worst thing in the world we could do is say, oh, well, if they're making these bonuses, they're using AI, mm-hmm. then we should tax them. Like, okay, cool. Now you've created zero incentive for anybody to offer a lower cost version of this style. You know, if I have to pay, you know, $1,800 a month on health insurance, and you've made it sure that nobody can sell me health insurance for less than that because you will tax the difference in profits, I will never pay less than $1,800 for health insurance. And chances are my $1,800 a month policy will never get better. And these are sort of the counterintuitive things people often don't think about. Like, well, I saw a post from somebody well-meaning on Twitter a few hours ago. It's like, maybe it'd be better off if we, you know, postpone AGI or ASI to like 2030 or whatever because of the job loss. And it's like, replace AGI or ASI with curing cancer, preventing childhood disease, and then say it out loud and see how you feel about saying that. Because to me, the jobs is secondary. All that's downstream to the opportunity for this to improve the quality of our health. That is the first thing. We've seen AI right now, current AI is great at diagnosing. We're being limited by our own system to improve our quality of healthcare because AI is clearly ready to be deployed in many ways to do that. And as far as the job stuff, I think there's a lot of, we have to reframe the way people think about stuff. Like that's the thing that for our listeners out there, think about changing careers every 5 years. Think about continuously building skills. Think about investing, having your own investment, you know, putting away 10% of your money every year. Don't, you know, great if you get a good retirement salary or whatever from your company. You need to think like a solo creative, like an, you know, like, you know, a creative. You need to think about those things because everything's going to get frothy. I think eventually we'll probably like, you know, if you ask me one of the greatest pieces of financial technology, it's like Acorns. It's, you know, it's these tools that just say automatically invest, you know, a certain percentage of every purchase. Like Justin, did I tell you to do that years ago?
No.
I've used to give, that was my sort of talk to everybody. It was like, you know, every young person was like, go do the thing that automatically invests part of every time you purchase something that takes, you know, 25 cents or whatever to do that. And I think people are going to have to get into the mindset to do that because some of the artists I've talked to, I've had years later thank me for doing that because, you know, they realize they're like, oh, well, $30 a month, $50 a month doesn't seem like a lot, but 5 years, 6 years later, oh, shoot, that's the difference between that and maxing out your credit card.
Yeah. Obligatory reminder. One of my favorite phrases, may seem like a long way down the road, may seem like an awful lot to do. The time is going to pass anyway. And since it's going to pass anyway, maybe go ahead and make a small nudge now. That obligates, you know, future you to give up, you know, pennies or dollars or whatever, just forever. And then you'll never look back.
Yeah. And I've argued that if you're a little bit smart in how you spend, you know, maybe one less blooming onion a week, you know, one less little whatever, you all of a sudden find out that years later, like, wow, I have vacation money every year because of this. I mean, getting people into this mindset, and AI can be a great tool for that. You start thinking about having an AI, like, I don't know how many subscriptions I have right now that I pay for, you know, and like I'm using stuff that I probably don't need to be using, probably spending $500, maybe $1,000 a month or so on all sorts of different AI stuff and a lot of our tools I probably don't need. And if I start thinking about, man, if I have an AI financial advisor because I have AGI that takes over my stuff, I bet I will have a lot more money. I bet I will be able to weather, you know, worse periods a lot easier. And I think that should be applicable to everybody.
Yeah.
So my 2025 prediction is, I think we're going to have systems that are going to feel AGI-like. I think we're going to have, I'm going to tell my phone or my computer to go do a thing and it's going to get a thing done. I think that we're going to start to think that we may be done with email.
Mm.
I think that's my prediction is that 2025, we may realize like, okay, like the AI is smart enough to filter and handle this and respond to me and do this in more so than current AI email systems. I think that we're going to kind of like, emails, you're just going to have messages, you know, everything's going to become a message. You know, you're going to tell a thing, send a message here.
We're all of us are going to have the gatekeepers of the rich. If you wanted to get, let's say, Lady Gaga a message, you'd have to know somebody to know somebody who could expend capital to get a message to somebody who maybe will put it in front of her at some point. We're all going to be doing that. And
My theory on figuring out where innovation comes from is like very, very much like that. It's like, what do rich people have now? Because that tells you what somebody who has, if cost isn't an issue, what they have.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have, yes, they have a personal assistant that handles stuff for them. You know, they travel a lot. They have hassle-free travel. You know, they fly first class or they fly, you know, private jets, all these things. And, you know, they used to be, they had cell phones. They had these things. They had, you know, the ability to have any food they wanted. And then we invented microwaves, stuff like that. So anything the rich have. But also the thing I thought about too is the way the rich work. And if you think about some of the wealthiest people, whether they're CEOs or actors, The exception of people who are founders like Jeff Bezos or Zuckerberg, you know, a CEO of a company or a high level executive might be there 4 or 5 years. They may move around more than the people below them. And it's because they're always chasing other opportunities. And they also have accumulated enough capital. They don't have to keep doing the thing they don't want to do for a while. And I think that's the thing we have to think about is like, okay, well, how does, you know, I remember working at a TV network and working a project for a network and them saying, oh, we're going to go talk to so-and-so about the show that just got greenlit. Like, why are we doing this? Like, it's just a formality. Like, they don't have any say here. I'm like, what do they do? Like, oh, well, we just put them in this. We gave them this title. They're just in this office. They have no power right now. I'm like, what? And that was like, that was their way of firing. As they give you, they'll put you in another, they'll sideline you for that. You spend a year on their dime, you know? And meanwhile, this is a show where I'm scraping and scrounging, you know, literally for pennies to be able to like, you know, get things done. And there's somebody, you know, making a very, very Manhattan TV executive salary doing effing nothing. And that was their courtesy that they had for each other. But I think we'll start to think about that. I think another thing to think about do is teams, is building teams. Is like, you might say, I'm going to create a team with my friends and we're going to look for opportunities and we're going to, you know, share information, do things so that maybe work on projects together, et cetera. But that's beyond 2025.
Yeah. So what was your specific measurable 2025?
You're going to have an agent within your computer that's going to be reliably doing email or Excel. Like you're going to feel.
God, yeah, talk about a place where Google should dominate. Like, you know, that's the no brainer is just introducing the brand new Gmail.
I mean, yeah, because essentially, like, it's important and unread feature was good enough 14 years ago. I have to imagine that with the data sets they'd have, it can. I imagine that its predictive suggestions for responses are chump change hilarious compared to what it could do now.
Can I tell you the problem that Google and other AI companies or other companies in general have is when. Yeah, and this was an observation I made from watching Dropbox, which I've talked about before. Drew Houston was asked, like, are you worried about Google with Platypus and what they were going to do for their infinite, you know, their online hard drive, whatever? And he said, you know, right now they have their C engineers on that or B engineers. When they put their A+ engineers on it, then I'll worry. And it took 6 years before Google took that seriously and then created G Drive, and which is great. It hasn't improved much. They've tried to throw Gemini into it and it's effectively useless. Google has the talent and the people to go in and build an amazing email experience, but the really capable engineers and product managers that can do that, can they keep them around? That's the question. You know, they had, you know, Notebook LM, which was their really cool, you know, podcast notebook thing. That was a Google Labs, like, hey, here's a little side thing. And for all the things that all the millions of dollars they spent trying to attract attention to all the stuff Gemini was doing, Notebook LM, which was not a featured product, was not a thing that had any sort of attention other than just sitting in Google Labs, was a thing that blew up. And the head of that left Google.
Yeah. Because he's like, I don't have a future here. I want to build something else outside of it.
And you know, at OpenAI, we have people, you know, like, you know, people from the OpenAI, like a lot of people, like, why is this person leaving? Like, they were there since 2018 or 19. They were there a half a decade ago. They've been there at an extremely long amount of time, and people just started paying a ChatGPT 2 years ago. Don't realize the OpenAI story started a long time ago. So you have people worth tens of millions of dollars who are now, how many meetings do I want to be in a day? You know, do I really want to do this right now? Or do I want to take a break and just, do I want to, you know, maybe come back? We always, some people that come back, you know, but like, you know, for me, it was like, man, I just want to build. I want to build. And I offered opportunity to kind of do that. But I'm like, yeah, you know, it would be cool, but I would be, you know, shoving things into like a tiny corner and not kind of being able to sort of do things on a wider, bigger scale that I'd imagine myself doing. But you see that at companies. So I'd say that that's the problem that Gmail is going to run into, is that technically there's the capability there, but, you know, can they get a product?
Well, it gets it, the Google thing. And if we go any further, then we're just going to rehash our general Google grievances. But it's like, there's no reason why they shouldn't. They have all of the raw ability, knowledge, and talent. But yet I agree with you, they probably won't.
And the problem you have there too is that I have, you know, I know a lot of people came from Google to go to other companies. And when they go to a faster paced startup, they're shocked by like, do you hear about ghost engineers at Google and your people that kind of clock into Google because you just learn the minimal amount of thing. A lot of, cause you get in there, you get frustrated after a certain amount of time and you're just whatever I have to commit each week to keep my job and nobody will know that I'm there. And that's why there's a lot of talk of like getting rid of remote work.
I was just going to say that. Nobody talks about that, but that's a huge part of like the whole return to office thing is that it's a lot harder to work at two companies simultaneously when you are in an office somewhere. Yeah. And that happens. It happens.
I know remote people, Google remote workers from Google that got like all sorts of side gigs and stuff, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That's like, is this even ethical?
I know people that have simultaneously worked for two big companies
as full-time employees.
Employees for like multiple months. It was a transition from one company to another, but they strung it out as long as they possibly could between it. And that's like, that was in a situation where they had to do a lot of like on-camera meetings. Like there are a lot of engineering jobs where it's like, hey, just commit the code and you know, that's the job. You don't have to be in these windows where it's a lot easier to do it. But that's part of it is like, hey, look, yes, a lot of these companies are pissed that they rented these offices and they pissed that they have all these desks and all this nice accoutrement that they want people to come in for. But there is an element of like, hey, just for, you know, corporate espionage reasons, please work from the office.
Well, I'll say this is that of the AI companies I know that are really cooking, that are really moving fast, they're in office.
Yeah.
They're in office. I moved to SF because I wanted to be in the office because I knew being in the office was how I was going to be around. Not just, you know, I could, you know, they're perfectly happy me doing my job, but I wanted to understand, you know, the state of things. And I knew that by being in office, I could be around people. And that was the greatest decision I ever made.
I was going to say, this is something that Malcolm Gladwell talks about in his Revisiting of the Tipping Point book that just came out, where it's like your physical proximity to things, everything from the culture to the ethics you do, to your opportunities, to just the stuff you know. It's like any kind of molecules bouncing around, blending together and having reactions. The physical proximity matters.
So OpenAI just announced Alec Radford has decided to leave after a long period of time. And, you know, great terms, may work with projects for them in the future, whatever. Sam Altman just put out a great tweet about Alec. Alec is one of these people whose name, whenever I'd hear people talk about certain people in AI, I could tell somebody was knew what they're talking about if they knew who Alec was. If they didn't know what Alec was, I'd be like, I'd be like, Alec's been the lead on some of the most important papers in AI. Alec was the one that read the paper on transformers that Google put out and said, oh my God, we should try. I mean, probably sit in the Alex, I can say, oh my God, but Alec looked at this and said, oh, we should try this. And that's where they did GPT-1, GPT-2, GPT-3. That came from Alec. Alec was the one that read the paper and said, we could apply this to that. I'd be in meetings, but being in the proximity of Alec, where, you know, we'd be in a meeting and watching him think and watching him work from one week to the next was amazing, an amazing thing. And just to be able to be like, yeah, I was there. Alec's one of these people, like, I think he's on the level with, you know, von Neumann or Shannon, whatever. I legit think he is on that level from then. You look at his contributions, and that was cool, is to be in a room and to be around that person. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, and super shy, unassuming guy, but, you know, I'm quietly fanboying out, like, this guy's so smart. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Say something else. Say something else smart. Come on.
You guys got picks? Pick words. Anyone?
Man, it's been a zoo here. I've been living to hand to mouth. I have no picks. I have fewer brain cells, and I have absolutely my pick is the snoo bassinet. It rocks your daughter to sleep.
All right. I've got a pick that I just started. David Eagleman wrote the book Incognito, which we've talked about. It's got some good metaphors about how to think of the brain. I found out that a few years ago he had another book called Live Wired, which is about how good brains are at remapping on things. There's a excellent episode of the podcast people I mostly admire on the Freakonomics Network that just dropped into the Freakonomics feed, where they talk with him about non-sighted people who are able to, you know, see with their visual cortex using feeling-based modalities, all the way to therapies where by wearing a wristband, you can eliminate tinnitus because the brain figures out that, oh, wait, real sounds also are accompanied by these vibrations on your wrist in various locations. And that high-pitched whinning that I'm hearing must not be a real sound. Therefore, let me just Photoshop it out. So they're able to cure tinnitus, bunch of weird stuff, neuroplasticity, children who have half their brains removed and are fine. All of that is in Livewired, which I'm reading right now.
I have to check that out. I was at David's house a few months ago, and he's got a cool podcast set up basically in like a wine cellar.
Oh, that's awesome. Go, son of a really biscuit. Of course you were hanging out with David Eagleman.
Oh, David. I'm with David for years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Eagle Man. So my pick, I introduced Brian to Bolt.new a while ago, which is a really easy to use if you want to try to create a piece of software tool. And the new one, there's a new company out that has one called Lovable.dev. I think that's it, which what I liked about Lovable, this is going to sound silly, as I could do it on my iPhone.
Wow.
And
wow.
Not that it's a great experience, but you could, it's, you know, I've had ideas where I want to write a choose your own adventure story generator where I just type stuff in and clicks this. Like I've written stuff like in 40 seconds. And had it deploy it. And so it now they connect into Supabase, so you can have a back-end database. This natural language decode tools are moving very, very fast. And I think that they're starting to integrate other resources and stuff. And so pretty soon somebody's gonna plug it into your Google, is gonna realize, oh, let's do a Google Docs integration and let you make really cool tools with your on top of your Google Docs, just in natural language. And I think that's gonna be amazing. So lovable.dev, I'm playing with that. That seems pretty cool so far.
Cool.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.